Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 2002, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a scientist. Like many of the cleverest in his field, he's a games player, most at home when he's pitting his wits against the challenges of the universe. Such a mighty contest doesn't permit specialisation. Theoretical physics, astrophysics, zoology, ecology, biology are just some, but not all, of the fields in which he's worked. Brought up by his mother in genteel poverty in a Sydney suburb, it was a teacher, as so often, who inspired the career he's enjoyed. It's taken him to all the best places, Harvard, Oxford, Cambridge, Princeton, and for the last half of the 90s he was chief scientific advisor to the British government. As the man who gave Tony Blair a crash course in GM crop technology, he understands the need to balance humanity with the avalanche of increasing knowledge. But he admits that the blending of passionate values and cold analysis does not come easily, quote. Now the president of the Royal Society, he is Bob May. Now Lord May, indeed, people's peer. Which do you prefer, the passionate values or the cold analysis, Bob?
I don't wish to make the choice. They're different things. We need to ask, with the potential that science opens to us, what are the doors we want to open and what are the doors we want to keep closed? What's the kind of tomorrow we want to build with the possibilities? That's about values and beliefs. And science has no special voice in the choices we should make.
Indeed, but when you became, as you did, for, as I say, the second half of the 90s, chief scientific advisor to the government, that was probably as close as you came to being in touch with the public in all of this, where you come head up against that kind of passion. And I wonder if you found that difficult or uncomfortable, that you, the scientist, were...
Well, maybe I should have, but I didn't. But I do draw the clear distinction between my views about things, which I sometimes hold very strongly, as distinct from the cold analysis bit, which is whatever the debate, whether it's about embryonic stem cells or GM foods, we should decide what we want to do, but it should be decided against as accurate as possible an understanding of what the facts are.
But in a society where you have freedom of speech and a free press, you don't always get that, do you? You got extremely annoyed with the press on occasions, didn't you? You accused them of talking
I said rude things. It's not quite the same as being extremely annoyed. I expressed my sometimes bewildered amusement in fairly direct terms.
But it is a culture clash to that extent, isn't it? That journalists and indeed politicians want straight answers and scientists can't always give them.
I would like to think that as chief scientist I always gave straight answers, but the straight answer is very often one doesn't know. The notion that most people have of science from things like weakest link is a set of certainties. That's how we see science.
It's what we require of it. It's what we require of you, the expert.
How else do you organise a curriculum or set an exam? And much of science is like that. But the things that really trouble us are the things at or beyond the frontier, where we don't yet know.
Sure, but then what you want is a sober, measured debate where the scientist and all his qualifications are heard, and that's not what you get in this kind
of... This is true. In the bit that troubles me is that some of the actors coming to it with strong beliefs of a non-scientific kind.
Passionate values,
which I approve of, will wish to bend the scientific facts to fit the values they hold. So I believe the values must have primacy.
And you call them crackpots.
No, I don't. Not always. Very rarely indeed. Only when I lose patience. And I respect the values because ultimately, in something like what we should allow and not allow in embryonic stem cell research, there are a background of facts, but people holding different values can honestly come to different decisions about what you want to do and not do, and I respect that as the judgment of society of how it wanted to use or not use this potential.
Understood. Tell me about your first record you're going to play on this desert island.
My first record is a reaffirmation of my essential Australianness, and it's by a chap called John Williamson, whom I think is a particularly interesting Australian, as it were, country western singer, and it is just about what it means to be an Australian.
I'm asking you, hey trooper, can you bear the load? Will you tie it up with wire just to keep the show on the road? Hey, true blue. Hey, true blue.
John Williamson and True Blue, a nod towards Bob May, the Australian. He might have been absent for, a quarter of a century, but he knows where his roots are, yes?
Yep.
It could be argued, I suppose, that now you're president of the Royal Society, you couldn't be further away from those classless Australian roots. I mean, the society is remote, it's hallowed, it's rarefied. What are you going to do about it?
Well, I'm not sure that's a good characterisation of the Royal Society. The Royal Society is, of course, the curiously named, really. It's the United Kingdom National Academy of Sciences.
Mm-hmm. But it's elitist.
It's democratically elitist. It has all the egalitarianism of science and all the recognition that not all ideas are equal and not all people are as successful as practitioners. So it's elitist in the sense that based on performance, not on birth or location, it elects people.
Because they are also, in the main, it has concentrated very much on the traditional sciences, hasn't it? There's nobody in there, as far as I understand it, who has made huge advances in new technology.
A misunderstanding. Although there's a germ of truth in it, but it's not in the constitution of the society, as it were. The society, if you go back to the Victorian times, it would have had in it people, notably Faraday, Wedgwood, Armstrong, people who went all the way from the frontiers of science to its application in industry. And the society today still, although the preponderance of the elections are people who have contributed to the creation of new knowledge, often in its most abstract form, it also recognizes in the form of applied and general candidates people who have translated that knowledge into useful things. Tim Berners-Lee, whom we elected as the person who created the World Wide Web.
What about women? I mean, you've got 1,200 fellows, they call them, and 44 of them are women. That's not very balanced.
Yes, and it's actually worse than that in the sense that of, not that I want to be ageist, but of fellows who live in the UK under the age of 65, there are something like 16 women out of something getting on for 400. If you look down to the next generation, I think the best way to start a career in science in any country in the world is the scheme that the Royal Society accidentally invented for young people, the university research fellows, who are given 10 years to do what they like, where they like, on their own terms. More than a third of those are women. The problem is simply that although we're doing well down in the younger age categories, it's going to take time for that to make its way through.
So in a sentence, how do you want to leave your mark on the Royal Society?
I want to build on what was begun by my predecessors, and I want to carry us further back, essentially the origins of the society, where it was much more broadly representative of science in society. I think in recent years there has been a slight tendency to drift toward recognising pure science accomplishments, and that has to be the core of our values.
But
it needs to be wider.
It
needs to be wider in its recognition that that extends to popularisers of science. It extends to people who create applications. It is not simply publications in elite journals. In
so science, it ceases to be remote and rarefied.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Record number two.
Well, against that background, I turn back to beyond my own birth to the song Carrickfergus. This comes from a record of Lorena McKinnitt's. I choose this because this is the town my father moved from when he was about 14 to move to Australia.
I will transport her, but I'll sing no more now till I get a drink. I'm drunk today, but then I'm seldom sober.
a handsome rover from town to town.
Carrick Fergus, sung by Cedric Smith and Lorena McKennett. Memories of your father, Robert May, who was born in Ireland, went out to Australia and met your mother, whose roots were Scottish. So you're a true Celt, Robert Macready May. Your father was a disaster as far as the family was concerned, I gather.
I never knew my father well, and it's only recently that I've come to learn more of the family through his sister. She was a journalist, and she's written a long and fascinating narrative account of the family's early years in Carrickfergus and then the move to Australia, which I think my father, moving from middle-class prosperity as a pharmacist's son in Carrickfergus to a period of real struggle and coming into a new society, could not have been easy.
But he left you. He left you when you were small.
Well, he suffered from devastating alcoholism. So I saw very little of him, and my mother divorced him when I was quite young.
Mm. And you didn't see him?
Very rarely. I saw him very rarely, and I didn't see him since the age of 17. It's one of these things that it was a messy divorce, it was a painful thing, and it just seemed, as my brother once put it, dealing with one parent is hard enough. But I wouldn't have my childhood any different in retrospect, on the grounds that, on the whole, I feel I've had such a lucky and privileged life, I wouldn't want to mess around with any of it lest I change the whole thing.
But you have said, even after he'd gone, that yours was a curious childhood,
I had asthma rather severely when I was young, and I missed a lot of school up to the age of about 13 or so. But I was the kind of child who spent a lot of time by itself, and I read voraciously. I have an extraordinary acquaintance with the ephemeral literature that goes back to the ephemeral literature of Annie Swan and people like that, of my grandmother, and then through sort of John Buchan and Bulldog Drummond and stuff like that from my mother's generation. And I inhabited a very rich world of the imagination.
So it was all teeming away inside, but you were the sort of solitary, sickly little boy sitting in bed.
Yeah, when I was little. I grew out of it.
As we shall hear. Tell me about your third record.
Well, the third record is, in a sense, a leap ahead to a year I spent at King's College in 1976. And it's partly for that reason that I chose the choir of King's College singing part of the Sanctus from Fauré's Requiem.
Sanctus from Fauré's Requiem, sung by the choir of King's College, Cambridge, with the New Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Sir David Wilcox. Tell me about the school teacher who inspired you, Bob. Who was he? How did he do it?
I had a succession of excellent teachers, but one particularly inspiring person, a chemist, name was Lenny Basser. He had through his hands 7 Fellows of the Royal Society, 1 Nobel Laureate, 3 members of the US National Academy of Sciences. He also coached the track team, which won the state high schools championship, and there are several hundred state high schools, 28 of the 31 years he coached it.
What a man.
Extraordinary man.
Yeah.
He had a kind of creative laziness in a way. For example, he didn't like marking exam papers, so he did this brilliant thing. The exam papers were handed back to the class and we marked each other's papers, which, if you think about it, is a brilliant, if somewhat occasionally abrasive, pedagogic device.
You went on being lucky, though, didn't you, with your teachers and mentors as you went on?
I've been extraordinarily lucky. I went to university to study engineering, but I got lured sideways into physics. My thesis committee were 3 people whose own thesis supervisors had been 3 of the giants of the early days of theoretical physics: Wolfgang Pauli, Rudi Piles, and Vicky Weisskopf. They were my intellectual grandfathers, as it were, and my thesis committee projected the air that you could start a new whole area like solid-state physics on a wet weekend, as it were, that the job of a theoretical physicist was a kind of wonderful arrogance, that you could take any problem and think, what are the essential simplicities, and go off, regardless of specialisation.
Which was right up your street, because you are a polymath.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm a polymath. It's a set of skills, it's a style that suits me.
You've also said you realised that life could be hugely enjoyable because you could spend the rest of your life doing the equivalent of what you also enjoy doing, which is playing snooker and chess.
Playing games with nature where the rules of the game are to try and work out what the rules are.
Record number four.
Yes, my fourth record, again, goes back to earlier years of my life. It's Pete Seeger singing The Bells of Rhymney. And I did not grow up with music, and music more came into my life when I met my wife as a postdoc at Harvard. And she in particular had been, when younger, a counselor in summer camps where Pete Seeger used to come. And I have always had great affection for him for all those associations. And I particularly like him on the 12-string guitar.
Is there hope for the future? Say the brown bells of Merthyr. Who made the mine owner? Say the black bells of Rhondda. And who robbed the miner? Say the green bells of Blenheim.
Pete Seeger singing The Bells of Rhymney, or Rhymney, as he calls them. Bob May, yours has by no means been a straight line from this polymathic student we were describing to the top of the scientific tree. There's been a lot of chance along the way there. So whatever the mysteries of life science can explain, it can't explain serendipity, can it? Or can it?
No, it can't, and never can.
But isn't chaos theory, which is my way of getting us onto this complicated subject, which has occupied so much of your professional life, a reaffirmation that there is always a mystery, that as fast as you learn the rules that appear to govern the world around us, they generate conditions which confound those rules, and something quite different and unpredictable happens?
Yes, but it's much more than that. Chaos theory doesn't tell us what you just said, because we always knew that. The world is complicated, and that makes it unpredictable. What chaos says is the simplest rules you can imagine, really, really simple things, can actually sometimes behave in a manner that is as complicated and as unpredictable as anything you can imagine. The dream that Newton bequeathed to us is a dream that we live in a world that's governed by rules, and if the rules are simple enough, motions of the planets around the sun, we can make predictive statements. And the things we can't predict are because they're very complicated. As my friend Martin Rees has once very tellingly put it, we could predict a century ahead the eclipse that many of us saw, but we couldn't predict the day before whether we'd actually be able to see the eclipse, because we can't predict the cloud structure.
Exactly.
It says there are situations, and local weather prediction is one of them. When I was young, we thought the problem was just computational power, more and more computers, better and better satellite information, we'll push prediction further and further ahead. Not true.
Does that mean we will then never know? Does it mean that it just takes us longer to work it out?
No, it means in principle, predictability beyond about 10 to 20 days of local weather will probably always be impossible, because the system is so sensitive to the conditions of the moment, that in the poetic terms, the flapping of a butterfly's wings can carry you 10 or 20 days out to a different end point.
Did you explain all this to the Prime Minister?
That's not one of the things I had a conversation with either John Major or Tony Blair about, but I do assure you I've explained it to many people, and I've tried to explain to them that chaos as depicted, for example, in Jurassic Park, is not chaos. I mean, there you had this character running around telling everybody that chaos said the world was complicated and things would go wrong, which you didn't need chaos to do that, and I couldn't wait till the dinosaur ate him.
You did, I have to say, explain Fermat's last theorem to the Queen.
I did. And in fact, very nicely, I had written a note, as was my habit, suggesting when Andrew Wiles got a special recognition for it. He couldn't get the Fields Medal because the Fields Medal is ageist. You can't get it if you're over 40. And I got back a really nice letter from Balmoral saying they had all been fascinated in this person who had, the theorem had been round since the 1600s. They'd looked it up in the encyclopedia and it wasn't very enlightening. Could I explain? And so I gave two sides of A4. One side tried to explain what the theorem did, and the second page tried to say why it was interesting, why it wasn't just a piece of mathematician saying, I'm cleverer than you.
And did you get a reaction?
I got a very nice reaction when I did next see the Queen, and she said that they had read it with interest and didn't guarantee they understood it, and in what I hope was pardonable less majesty, I said there would not be a quiz.
Next piece of music.
My next piece of music, again, goes back to my wife, in that in Judy's house, music was always playing and almost always Mozart. Her father was immensely fond of it. My own CD of this is one that I inherited from her father. It's Mozart's String Quartet in B-flat major.
The last movement of Mozart's String Quartet in B-flat major, played by the Smetana Quartet. You it was, Bob May, who predicted back in the mid-80s that AIDS would ravage the African continent. People accused you of scaremongering. Other experts, they didn't like it, did they? But you were right.
Well, it was myself and a colleague, Roy Anderson, who published the first prediction of the likely demographic consequences of HIV and AIDS for Africa. And we were criticised by the World Health Organization and the Population Council, who shortly after had also produced mathematical models with more optimistic outcomes. And there's an interesting general point that emerges. When you're well behind the frontiers of science and you understand it, then any trained person can lift the stuff off the shelf and do a good job. Most of the advice to government is like that. And the routine, well-trained, good people are probably better than Nobel laureates because they won't get bored. When you're at or beyond the frontier, you really have to get the people who are used to, as it were, climbing the clean rock, not using ladders and cables to help them. And what happened for the WHO people and the World Population Council people, rather sensibly used standard epidemiological models, which for various technical reasons didn't fit the transmission of HIV. Whereas Roy and I turned to ask what facts are there, and we produced models that were less mathematically elegant, but more in accord with the facts, and for that reason were more gloomy in their predictions.
And but ultimately more accurate.
And I wish we'd been wrong. I wish we'd been wrong.
Next piece of music.
My next piece of music, again, is in a sense in one of the cusps of my life. It's Bob Dylan's Blowing in the Wind, which is, I think, one of the canonical statement of the spirit of the 60s. And it was my own entrainment toward the end of that time, 69-70, in the founding of the Movement for Social Responsibility in Science in Australia that quite accidentally led to me as a physicist getting interested in ecological environmental questions.
How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The The answer is blowing in the wind.
Bob Dylan and Blowing in the Wind. There are so many areas, Bob May, that one could ask you for a quick, straight answer on. Let me throw some of them at you. What about the food we eat? Factory farming means our chickens have a high incidence of salmonella, and they're given growth hormones. The lice breeds among factory-farmed salmon. Do you worry about that? Do you eat these things? Should we?
Well, interestingly, when our daughter was young, she was not passionately vegetarian, and we drifted to a semi-vegetarian sort of diet. Fact is, by and large, in our household, we do eat birds and fish, but not mammals.
So you do eat factory farm? You don't look for free-range eggs, free-range chickens?
No, not in general.
But isn't the truth that organic agriculture as a whole is better for us, in inverted commas, but it's morally indefensible because we can't feed the world that way?
Well, I would put it right round the other way. I'd say there isn't, as to my understanding, is that it is doesn't offer any additional nutritional or health benefits, but what it does offer is a more friendly attitude to the environment than most forms of farming, and therefore there's an ethical benefit but not a health benefit.
But although a lot of the things you've said when you were scientific advisor about GM crops seem to be contradictory, I never quite got to the bottom of it, but it seemed to me that you are in favour of GM crops because you know that's how you can feed the world, and organically you can't.
No, I have a taxonomy of concerns and worries about GM foods, which is threefold. Food safety, I don't think there are any risks that aren't there in any novel food stuff. Environmental worries of things like producing superweeds. Well, we always have to worry about alien invaders, and we have things in a ranunculus in the Norfolk Broads, rhododendrons around the coast path. They all come from garden centres, and there's no evidence whatsoever to suggest GM crops pose any risks that ordinary conventional crops don't pose. Then there's a third category of worries where I worry a lot. After all, the legitimate aim of farming is to grow food that no one but us eats. We don't share with weeds, which are just plants in the wrong place, or with pests, which are just insects with the wrong appetites. And the more we get toward realizing the ideal of growing food that no one eats but us, then the more silent will be the spring. I wish us to move to ask how we use this new way of producing crops, which is what we've been doing all through our history since the dawn of agriculture, in ways which give us a greener agriculture, a doubly green revolution, a revolution which makes us yet more effective, because we're going to have to do that to feed tomorrow's population. We couldn't feed today's world with yesterday's agriculture, and we won't be able to feed tomorrow's world with today's, but to do it in a way that is more environmentally sensitive, producing crops that are water tolerant, salt tolerant, resistant to particular insects while not putting stuff on them that kills all sorts of other things. In short, shaping the agriculture to its environment rather than wrenching the environment to the agriculture with fossil fuel energy subsidised things.
Now, this is the tutorial you gave to Tony Blair.
Yes, yes. It was a very apt pupil he was.
Record number 7.
It's a Schubert Lieder, based on one of Heine's poems, Der Atlas, Atlas Carrying the Burdens of the World, with the baritone sung by Ralph Cohn. That has a sentimental association in that Ralph Cohn is a friend and he's a benefactor at the Royal Society, and he's the person who generously put up the funds for the Royal Society's enterprise on science and society.
Herz, du hast es ja gewollt.
Schubert's Der Atlas, sung by Ralph Cohn, accompanied by Graham Johnson. So you sit on your desert island, Bob, and wrestle with the problems you wrestle with at the moment, really. I mean, nothing much will change, really. Hmm?
Well, I don't know about that. I'd be really upset being on the desert island, I think.
What will you miss most? Family apart, of course. What would you miss most about your life today?
I would miss my friends and colleagues. I would miss the cut and thrust of sort of daily activity, whether it's the science itself or whether it's the science more in a social context. And I would miss the games I play. And I would miss tennis.
Snooker, bridge.
Don't play snooker anymore, which is what I spent much of my undergraduate days doing. It was the one subject I studied really devotedly. And I haven't played, although when younger I played chess and bridge both at the national level, I haven't played for many years. Contract bridge is the only training I ever had for administration and management, and brilliant training it is if you think about it. You have a partner, you have to make decisions under uncertainty, and very often you make the right decision brilliantly, but the opposing cards lie in an improbable way so that you get a disastrous result, and you have to cheerfully forget it and go without any disturbance on to the next hand. It's a perfect model for the civil service.
Last record.
My last record is the prelude to Wagner's Parsifal. I chose that partly because I like the opera, and partly because I like the theme of the holy fool that runs through it.
The end of the prelude to Wagner's Parsifal, played by the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Sir George Scholte. Now, if you could only take one of those eight records, Bob, which one would you take?
Well, actually, I'd take a Parsifal, although I would be wanting to take the whole opera.
I see. Well, we won't comment on that. What about your book? You've got the Bible, you've got the complete works of Shakespeare waiting for you.
I'm going to take a curious book, which is going to go with the other object. I'm going to take the book that my brother gave me for my 21st birthday, which is Capablanca's Best 100 Games in Chess. And I could keep myself cheerfully employed for the better part of a year working through that. And
hence your luxury is?
And my luxury is I'm going to take from the British Museum the Isle of Lewis chess set with those wonderful old things that were found on a back of a cave. That would be my chessboard.
Wonderful. Robert May, Lord May, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. Thank you.